To those who wreaked havoc in our Capitol today, you did not win. Violence never wins. Freedom wins. And this is still the people's house. And as we reconvene in this chamber, the world will again witness the resilience and strength of our democracy. For even in the wake of unprecedented violence and vandalism at this Capitol.
Thankful that for tonight, Hackley,
always right, like me,
Chicagoans might sleep like crazy monkeys.
Deep for lazy money.
Under an electrical blanket.
Underhanded electoral blackout.
Thick, American, impossible violence.
Distrustful silence, sir. Oh,
no, no, Flotsam.
What?
Violins, old chap. Violins!
Oh!
The elected representatives of the people of the United States have assembled again.
That was former Republican Vice President Mike Pence. On the evening of January 6th, it felt like democracy in that country was hanging by a thread.
It was a hot, dusty day in 1901 when they stretched Mayor Bill. There he was, flopping up there, turning all red, white, and blue, where the flag ought to be. Ring, ring, ring. That's the mayor's phone. I'm the mayor. That's my phone. But I'm not picking it up. I can't pick it up. I got the fiddlers. It's hot here in City Hall. I'm opening the window. Open, open, open.
The mayor is the problem. The what? Flagpole is
the answer.
We hung the first one.
We can hang another one.
The mayor is the problem.
I don't want this to become a tradition. It's hotter out here than I thought. I'm closing the window. Close, close, close. I can close windows with my mind, but I can't keep these Elmers from hanging me.
A violent mob had just invaded the Capitol building at the incitement of a sitting American president. They were trying to stop the legal election of his successor. It might feel like a long time ago now, or that things have gone back to normal, but my next guests say that cloud of doubt over democracy hasn't gone away. And it isn't just threatening America. Anne Applebaum studies authoritarianism. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and staff writer for The Atlantic. Her book, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, is just out in paperback. And Ben Rhodes is a former advisor and speechwriter to President Barack Obama. His new book is After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. Good morning to you both.
Morning. Morning.
Anne Applebaum, just briefly, what did you think when you saw thousands of Americans storm the Capitol building in Washington to stop Joe Biden becoming president?
I thought it looked like scenes that I've seen in other countries. It was a organized, motivated mob that, although its methods were questionable, and I'm not sure whether it could have succeeded, it intended to stop the nomination of Joe Biden from becoming president. I think the really important thing to understand about the mob was that it was not representative of polarization. These were not Republicans who were against Democrats. This was an anti-systemic mob. They were trying to block the process of democracy itself. And that's a kind of protest that we haven't had in the United States in a long time, depending on how you define it, maybe not since the Civil War.
The war is over! The brutal industrial law has been defeated by the gentlemanly agricultural South!
Ah, see? Bet you didn't know the South won the Civil War. This is Daddy.
No true Mississippi cowherd would leave his wine cellar undefended in such a dangerous time.
Okay, we don't want this part in here. It gets up to
think
some...
Think of the balls you'll have.
You're too young to think about that, Beulah Balls. Bells.
Okay. Now we gotta get to the part where they have this amazing vision.
That war criminal.
This is more of the point. Oh, this is good.
What? Tom, you're back!
Uncle Field Marshal Thomas Lawbury, quadroon, honey, I'm back, and I'm beautiful.
I'm so glad that you're back, Tom.
It's good to have you.
See, there are many, many things that you don't know.
That's right,
everything
Tom,
you know is wrong.
I forgot. You're a free man now.
Oh, this is the best part of the play.
No, I ain't, General. I'm expensive. As a professional state well, now, you've been wanting over this kinky old government for over 60 years, and now you plan to pay for your puppet tax. Put it right here, in the bag.
Less for me, and die first.
slave all the time, no more. Wigwam take turns, and guess who's doing it in now?
So it represented something new in contemporary American politics.
Ben Rhodes, a majority of Republican congressmen and congresswomen voted not to ratify the election of Joe Biden. So did a number of Republican senators. What did that tell you about the state of two-party democracy in the United States?
Well, I think what it suggests is the uncomfortable truth that one of America's two major political parties is not committed to democracy, full stop.
Senators! The news of the emperor's death saddens us all. Thank you. But we cannot let our grief intervene in the necessary prosecution of our civic responsibilities. Therefore, we must perform the tedious but necessary ritual so vital to the stabilization and perpetuation of the Roman Empire. We must, in sober counsel, and with all deliberate speed, elect a new emperor.
All right. Everybody put their heads down on their desks now. No peeking. All right. All in favor of Gluteus Maximus, raise your hand. 61. All right. Now, everybody in favor of Varius Flavius, say aye.
Aye.
Vote for Flavius. IV.
He's got the Ivy League vote.
VIVIXXXI. Varius Flavius has 31.
Gluteus Maximus is the new emperor. And baby Varius Flavius is the new hall monitor.
Oh, hail Caesar Gluteus!
And, you know, this has been happening in plain sight, you know, for a long time. And for my book, a starting point for me jumping off was talking to a Hungarian activist about their transition to kind of a soft autocracy, single-party autocracy over a decade. I said, well, how did that happen? He said, well, you know, Viktor Orban, our prime minister, got elected on a right-wing populist backlash to the financial crisis. He redrew parliamentary districts to entrench his party in power, changed voting laws to make it easier for his supporters to vote, packed the courts with kind of far-right judges who side with him. He enriched some cronies who bought up the media and turned it into a right-wing propaganda machine. And he wrapped it all up in a nationalist us versus them bow, the real Hungarians, us versus them, the liberal elites, the Muslims, the immigrants, George Soros. And you could have been describing, you know, what's been happening for a decade in the United States. The Republican Party has embraced fundamentally illiberal means for entrenching minority rule of the majority in this country. That didn't change after Joe Biden's victory. It didn't even change after that attempted insurrection at the Capitol. And to this day, we see really aggressive efforts to adjust the voting franchise in over two dozen states in this country. So this is very much still an open question. And I think we have to adjust to the reality that there's one political party that would rather hold power than exist within a democracy in which they're agreed upon rules and reality.
You tweeted yesterday, the Republican Party, like any authoritarian movement, wants you to become cynical and apathetic so they can take away your power. You believe the Republican Party is an authoritarian movement?
Yes. And I think, you know, I don't want that to be the case. You know, the speeches I wrote for Barack Obama in the 2008 campaign were about red states and blue states coming together. I wish I didn't have to come to these conclusions. But I don't know, until we find the appropriate and accurate language for describing what's happening, I'm not sure how we're going to deal with it. Because any part, you know, their leader is Donald Trump, a person whose only cause right now is propagating the big lie that he somehow won this election. And a majority of Republicans in this country believe that to be true. And that, you know, there's so many characteristics of an authoritarian movement, and Anne has written a lot about this as well, where you change literally reality so that your supporters live in an alternative reality. And so that the only true cause is the acquisition and maintenance of power. And absolutely a characteristic of a Putin or an Orban or anybody who subscribes to this brand of politics is to make your opponents so turned off, cynical, apathetic, believing that nothing can change, that you can continue to move forward with your agenda of controlling things.
Anne Applebaum, what's the long-term effect of what Ben Rhodes called the big lie that the election was stolen?
So first of all, let me make one adjustment to what he just said, namely that I don't think that the battle for the Republican Party is over. I do think that there's a part of the party that is going to try to resist this you know, the authoritarianization of the party and the transformation of the party into something undemocratic. I think there are still people in it, even in Congress, even in the Senate, who feel strongly about that. Not everybody yet understands what's happening. One of the characteristics of a country which is sinking into authoritarianism is that not everybody recognizes it. I mean, if you'd asked Hungarians at the beginning of Viktor Orban's first term, you know, is he an authoritarian leader? They would have said, of course not. If you'd asked Venezuelans in the early days of Chavez's governments, is this country still a democracy? Then most of them said yes. And in fact, we have that polling data. The understanding of what's going on, I don't think, has penetrated that far. And so I think the battle is still on and it still can be won, although, you know, obviously we're at an advanced stage of it.
Hmm. I guess the concern, though, is that the rot settles in, right? That this lie can have legs, that it doesn't go away just after even an insurrection in January. It doesn't go away after months or years, that can settle in and destabilize something as fundamental as democracy.
Yes. I mean, what's really dangerous about what Trump is doing, you asked about the big lie, the big lie being the lie that he won the election, is that we've seen how conspiracy theories like this have worked in other countries.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
This weekend at the Memorial Armory, Bear Whiz Beer is proud to present
the Everything You Know Is Wrong Expo.
It's a new age festival of ignorance.
It's a hopeful feast of mindless fellowship.
This weekend at the Memorial Armory.
The Everything You Know Is Wrong Expo.
Crop circles.
Strange holes in the ground.
Things that aren't even there.
People watching you.
Voices only you can hear.
Hopes. Fears. Imaginings.
The Everything You Know Is Wrong Expo is a whole Slaffer Enterprises production.
Plus Ginzo Pyramid Slicing Knife free.
So sharp it cuts itself.
Nowadays, you don't necessarily need a full-fledged authoritarian ideology. You don't need Marxism. You don't need fascism. You don't need, a whole, theory of economics and a vision of the future in order to convince people to lose faith in their democracies.
I like the future. I'm in it.
I build it myself, and I love it.
I'm not sure.
Personally, I'm very pleased.
No, I think it's going to be all right.
I can dig it.
How do I like the future? Yeah. Well, the future's not here yet, man.
Smaller, but cleaner.
Right on.
I said live it or live with it.
Straight ahead.
Well, I think it has quite a great future in it. It's electric.
All you need is a lie that's powerful enough to undermine people's faith in the system and to break the consensus. I'm talking to you from Poland, where I watched this happen in the years between 2010 and 2015. I mean, it's a long story. There was a plane crash that killed a president, and over time, the idea that the entire Polish establishment had somehow collaborated in his death became widespread enough that it led people to lose their faith in the entire Polish establishment, as it would. What Trump is doing now is something very similar to that. In other words, he's telling people the voting system doesn't work, the media is lying to you, the establishment is lying to you, what everybody says isn't true, I'm really the president, Joe Biden's not the president. And all he needs to do is convince enough people that that might be true. You know, it's just it creates enough doubt about democracy itself that it opens up pathways to behavior that we haven't seen before, at least not since the Civil War. So you don't need a whole elaborate ideology or an explanation. All you need to do is make people doubt the system, to cease to believe in it, and to therefore believe that violence is possible and maybe necessary, that extra legal means are needed, to take back control. This is a tactic that we've seen in a lot of other times and places.
It wasn't JFK who was shot in Dallas. It was Bing Crosby.
I can't be
toilet is a gateway to the dreams.
It's a graze. They're behind the plan to make us marry our toaster.
I'm Foster's fence muscle. It's in a jar at the White House with Hillary's car.
The great sea didn't put electricity in my toothpaste.
Someone on the Supreme Court's a woman, and it's not the one you think.
Angels on asteroids are abducting crop circles.
It's not coming to an end, because it never began.
It's 11:05:30. High time for a bright light to pierce the conspiratorial darkness. No, I'm not afraid to talk about it, so don't come up on me. I'm Harold Hiphugger with Night Whispers.
Good evening. I'm here beneath the biggest party of the millennium under the stands at Homeless Stadium. And it's time for Fun Fun Town's most controversial radio broadcast. And my only guest tonight, well, I suppose I'm actually his guest, General Y2K, commander of the
Present.
Last Minute Men. Y2K, that's not your real name, is it, Mildew?
These are the last minutes of the last hours of the last century, Hiphugger. The countdown for liberty has begun, and before the nameless faces of the New World Order can pull the switch, I'm pulling it.
Well, that's fascinating, General.
I was napping poolside at the Gulf War Swimdrome when the government put a chip in my ass, and I'm not going to take it sitting down. It's high noon, daylight slavery time, and as of now, you take your orders from us. And that means me.
Well, you hold right onto that thought, General, because I've got some ant farms to sell here. As you know, dear friends, these DOA ant farms are a lot safer than the Scorpion survival yo-yos we offered last week.
What the hell's a survival yo-yo?
They've got a little compass in them.
They got a knife?
No. If you want a knife, that's the Swiss Army Scorpion survival yo-yo.
You're giving me a brain cramp.
Yeah. Anyway, dear friends, these ant farms are an easy care miracle. No food, no water required, because all these little monsters are dead on arrival under the sand at the bottom of the box. Just send $29.99 gold or silver coin only to Post Office Box I-210, Donkey Dump, Utah. So, General Waituki, you're giving the orders, you say?
Right. One. I want to order one of those ant farms.
We don't have to do that. I'll give you this one.
Okay. Two.
No, I can only give you the one because
it's
No.
Okay, then B. All washing machines, rice cookers, bread makers, coffee makers, chainsaws, and dust suckers are to be destroyed.
The chainsaws? No.
Well, not chainsaws, but everything else.
Well, tell us why, can you, General?
They're all time-saving devices, aren't they? And who's getting the time they're saving? You know, I think action speaks louder than words. Right. Lights up.
Wait,
all right, men.
Huh?
Let's massacre those Mr. Coffees. The bastards! Cease fire! Now we'll make coffee the old cowboy way. Boil it up in your hat.
What was the point of that, General?
You don't know from Doodly Squad, do you, Puke? Those 50 little bubbling bastards we just terminated saved the enemy 3 minutes a day. We just took back 150 minutes, and that doesn't suck!
It took them back from who?
The gaggle of maggots in the eyeball hats.
No,
right, men?
No. Those eyeball hats are a novelty item. I've got a very good deal on them coming up later in the
Negatory
show tonight.
Negatory, Hal. Mm-hmm. My men torched the eyeball warehouse this morning. We nuked them till they glowed and shot him in the dark.
No, all my tax records were in that warehouse. Look, let's just go to the phones.
Hal, put a hold on the phones. That general's as buggy as a bum's blanket. I'm pulling you out of there pronto now.
Yeah, come on, Hal, man. Get back to the station. Ray's got some bubbly. Be good for your nose. Get out of there.
Thank God. The microphone is all yours,
what
General.
What about the phones? Hey, where are you going, Mr.
Eyeball? I'm going to turn up your volume out in the truck.
I don't want to say that kid sucks, but he certainly inhales deeply. All right, men, line up the dust suckers!
Ben Rhodes, in 2008, there were two big events. One was the economic meltdown. The other was that the United States elected its first black president. How important were those events, do you think, in creating a shift away from representative democracy and planting the seeds for what we're talking about now?
Well, I think really important. And obviously, people felt this at the time with the financial crisis, but I think the impact was even greater than we understood at the time, or at least that I understood at the time.
What was that impact?
Well, what I think it did is, across the West, essentially, I think it marked a moment in which a significant number of people just lost faith in the process of American-led globalization and capitalism, and to some extent in democracy itself. And if you look at a place like Hungary, there had already been a building sense that maybe the new system wasn't working for everybody. And then when you have the bottom completely fall out, and you're seeing a situation when it looks like the system is rigged, and this system, it's not the same as the old system, but it's not offering me a sense of belonging and identity, and it appears rigged. And a guy like Orban steps into that moment and says, well, look, maybe I can't solve all the problems. And as Anne said, what's interesting is there's not a big economic ideology to this. What I can offer you, though, is the most familiar form of belonging in human political history, which is nationalism. I can offer you the kind of blood and soil nationalism of I will at least give voice to your grievances. And I think you see across the next decade in many different places, this common emergence of the kind of politician who, again, isn't putting forward a particularly economic program. What they're putting forward is some longing for a more traditional sense of identity.
The way things used to be.
The way, make America great again, make Russia great again, make Hungary great again, make Turkey great again.
When I was traveling in Turkey back in the mid-60s...
It's appropriate to talk about this at Thanksgiving.
It is.
Go ahead.
I come into this small town called Kilis, and I sit there...
Kilas?
Kilis.
Kill them.
Kilis, and I say, what's happening tonight? And they say, movie, there's a movie, let's go see a movie. So I expect to go someplace called, like, you know, the Kilis Bijou. It was the side of a mosque.
Uh-huh.
And they were showing...
The Mosque of Zorro.
They're showing a movie called, with Yul Brynner, called The Opium Is Also a Flower. The Poppy Is Also a Flower.
Oh, yeah.
It was that opium movie. So I'm sitting here seeing this movie about opium in Lower Turkey.
How's that against for opiums?
And all these, you know, and they're going up and they're grabbing these things, go by like these big bugs, and I think they're going to swat them. They're eating them, man. They go, eat them. I'm like, wow, I'm ready. Hey. I'm not in Kansas anymore. Yes. Hey,
see, we call that fly bean.
Bean.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Faul. Oh, that's masca. Masca bon faul. Yeah. Be faul. Very good.
Always a long for a traditional identity. I do think the 2008 crisis was this kind of destabilizing moment. And what's interesting is the backlash didn't come from a populism of the left that says, you know, we have an economic system that favors the 1% and screws everybody else. It came from the right, where I think politicians understood that there was so much grievance built up, that kind of identity politics could work. Now, in the United States, what was so interesting to me is to look at the parallel rise of the Tea Party movement to the rise of Viktor Orban's movement in Hungary, because you saw the same grievances. People who felt left behind by an economy that no longer worked for them, people who could look at the whole system and think it was rigged against them and to favor, you know, a handful of elites, and the political establishment had failed and the capitalist establishment had failed. And there's a black president.
Yeah. Well, you're a person of the colored...
Persuasion,
aren't you? Yes.
Yeah, I've been persuaded since I looked in the mirror that indeed I was the colored.
You certainly do have a great sense of humor.
We're known for having larger senses of humor than our Eastern brother.
Yes. Well, black. That's, yes. Uh-huh.
And I think that the racialized component in the United States, given the fact that race has always been at the center of a certain kind of white grievance-based politics, you mix together the cocktail of the anger over the financial crisis and the anger over a black president, and you get those mobs of Tea Party activists in 2010 chanting, take our country back. And to me, that was a moment, that 2010 election in this country that vaulted the Tea Party to power, that's when the Republican Party really started to go down this road of essentially a white grievance-based politics. Not all about race, again. Some of this is very much tied to dissatisfaction with the system generally. But when you mix race into that equation in the United States, it can become very potent. And by 2011, we have Donald Trump with the birther movement beginning his takeover of the Republican Party.
And the subtitle of your book is The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. I know that, I mean, in reading this, you have had a lot of conservative anti-communist friends, and some of them drifted towards authoritarianism. You've spoken to some of them since you ended up splitting on kind of ideological lines. What is that seductive lure of authoritarianism?
First of all, Everybody has always known that there's a lore of authoritarianism, including the greatest theorists of democracy. The authors of the American Constitution, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, were well aware that democracies had failed in the past. They were well aware of the power of demagoguery. One of the reasons the United States has the quirky constitution that it has is they were trying to build in as many checks and balances, as many ways that you could prevent an autocrat from coming to power as they possibly could. So the idea that this is something new is our generation's problem. Past generations have known that, and what they've known is that there is an element of the human character that dislikes chaos, that dislikes change, that dislikes diversity. Not everybody feels that way, but some people do. And particularly in times of great turmoil. And I would add to Ben's description of the financial crisis, I would add to that the transformation of the information space created by the internet and social media. And the cascading consequences of that. I would add to that the feeling that we now live in this era of information overload, of cacophony, of angry, divisive argument, of problems that can't be solved. And when you live in an atmosphere of that, that affects some people quite strongly, and it affects people in all social classes and people on the right and people on the left. But it does lead for a desire for something more unified, something more, something stricter, and perhaps something led by one person. The Trump administration understood this desire and this instinct very well. When you saw last summer, when they sent a kind of police force that nobody knew existed. This was the Department of Homeland Security police troops from the Coast Guard and from other parts of the Border Guard. When they sent them to Portland to do battle with demonstrators, that was a visual picture that was created for the benefit of people who are afraid of disorder.
Police state!
Police state!
Police state!
Help! It's the police!
Policemen! Real policemen, it's policemen will become.
Who's number one?
Peacemen, yes, we're peacemen, even though we wear a gun.
It's all in fun.
Police state, where green rookies become hardened men in blue, where danger wears a diploma and crime gets taught the lesson it deserves. Listen now as the Federal Bureau of Marijuana, in cooperation with Crime Lord Magazine, presents challenge number 13, Roach Patrol at Police State.
And the fact that they kept talking about disorder and flashing photographs of disorder all the way through Trump's campaign was because they were seeking to appeal to people who fear that. And we do live in a time of rapid change, of divisiveness, as I said, of cacophony. There were a lot of demonstrations last summer. And in those times, you find that people are drawn to something different. They want stability. They want, they want safety. They want something that seems, that seems familiar. Many of them, we've already talked a little bit about this nostalgia that people feel for a time in the past when supposedly things were more predictable, more stable. Some of them like to hear that message as well. And I think that there are a number of political leaders all over the world who are seeking to appeal to that strain in humanity. And it's happened in the United States, as well as many other places.
Do you worry that fighting for democracy is a lost cause then? I mean, in the book, you say that given the right conditions, any society can turn against democracy. Indeed, if history is anything to go by, all of our societies eventually will.
I don't believe there's such a thing as a lost cause. I mean, the future is never inevitable. Everything depends on the choices that we make today. We can change the circumstances that we live in. I mean, we can, for example, regulate the internet, by which I don't mean censor it. I mean, think harder about how the algorithms work that decide what it is that that makes us angry and excited and divided. We can create alternatives to public service alternatives to social media that value consensus and civilized discussion rather than shouting and performing. There are ways that we can change the current situation if we want to. But it is important that people understand exactly how grave the situation is, what extreme circumstances we find ourselves in, and how, you know, how easy it is to lose democracy and how difficult it is to regain it once it's lost.
Ben Rhodes, you were part of the Obama administration for 8 years. The subtitle of your book is Being American in the World We've Made. What sort of world has America made?
You know, well, I think that if you look at in the book, I kind of look at the 30 years since the end of the Cold War that kind of brought us from that moment when it seemed like democracy was at its high watermark and inevitable to where we are today. And obviously nothing is inevitable. As Anne says, each generation has this kind of cycle of conflict between democracy and authoritarianism. But what I found is, you know, we have to acknowledge as Americans there's some symbiosis between the kind of nationalist authoritarian trend we see around the world and the momentum of that American hegemony for 30 years. And I really looked at kind of three areas in which I think the excess of America's hegemony contributed to this trend. One, which we've discussed, but the kind of unbridled, unregulated brand of capitalism that, you know, washed across the world, mm-hmm. creating a lot of wealth, by the way, lifting a lot of people out of poverty, doing a lot of good, but also creating a lot of inequity and a lot of anger and ultimately the bottom falling out, the extent to which that created some of this vacuum that has particularly been acute since the 2008 crisis. I think our post 9/11 foreign policy.
Salamat, I have Ayem al-Zawahiri on the satellite conference phone.
Ace is Jeremy. Let's be excellent with these boys. It's big billing time, and Baghdad is paying. Ayman, are you there?
Yes, I am here. I am here. Yes.
This is Slim Lad Falsehood, and I have my partner, Jeremy Oversolt, on the line. Jeremy?
Well, hi. My friend, before Osama joins us, we want to be assured that you are not working for CIA or Semical Tentacle of the American Octopi.
Oh, get real, cheek, sweetie. You're talking with the premier public relations firm in the world.
That's right.
Those square hairs at Langley and those nervous nerds at the NSA can't afford us. They ain't got your petro bucks, little brother.
Yeah, Ayman. Chill out. Think of us as spin doctors without borders, okay?
That's groovy.
Now, put the lion on the phone and let's get him well.
Well, all right. Osama, image consultant on line two.
Hello. Hello, death to America.
And a Merry Christmas to you, Ben Booby. Hey, what do you say we get beyond the state slogans and stale slogans and fix your image, which, by the way, is totally in the toilet.
This is holy war, not popularity contest.
Oh, it's the same thing. An army travels on its ratings. Now, why do you think your boys ankled out of the North?
American bombs.
Wrong. Low self-esteem. You're running out of self-esteem. You're getting trashed from Tehran to Trenton because you look like losers.
We ran a focus group, Benny. You need a complete makeover or ba-ba-boom, the Taliban is an also-ran.
That's right.
Makeover. What exactly do you
All
have
right,
in
first,
mind?
Tell him.
Brim the beard. Tailor the turban into a do-wrap thing. So
Get
you
it?
Burn that flowing bathrobe you're wearing because that 60% of the focus group said it reminds them of the Golden Girls.
I suppose you want that brave leader to dress like Madonna, the great Satan's whore?
Oh, my God, that's beautiful. The great Satan's whore.
Like
she's been looking for a new album title. She is going to get wet over this one.
She'll
wear real missiles on her tits.
But back to you, Ben Man. Did you get the little thing we sent you for your next tape?
Yes, it is with me here.
Yes, but we are not certain it's the approach we wish to take.
Excuse me. You want to win, don't you?
Well,
of course, but the form is so youthful, so urban.
Turban. Yes. Okay, Binmeister, wake up. Smell the demons. Americans over 40 hate you like broken glass. They are bad data, gone forever. If we're going to put some nice on your queue, it's going to be with the youth. Rural and urban, we want them to grok your turban, capiche?
Binster, just kick it, okay?
Well, Osama, I think we must reach out and touch them before a bunker buster comes knocking on our door. What do you think, eh?
Well, then, by the great William, let it be done. Yo, this is Osama in the warrior's pajama going to bust a rap before I pop a cap in you great Satan's ass. You think I'd be afraid of you lame crusade? Let me hip you off for starters, my tally passer come to harm. And by the farm, we all be martyrs. Yeah, nobody here is a swat in Hades. We're going up a weft. 40 ladies gonna knock your socks off and get your rocks off in paradise. Tell that to Rum, Fell, Bush, and Connie Rice. This is a holy war. The flag's unfurled, you win or lose. But you gotta choose between jihad and living in McWorld. Just remember, while drag your sorry tush through snowy passes in the Hindu Kush. I may be losing in my cause downtrodden. You may be winning, but the one thing you ain't never been. Is Bin Laden.
Bin Laden.
Bin Laden. Bin Laden. Your pardon me, Bin Laden. You're low. You're low. You're low, baby Laden.
Not only contributed to, I think, the overreach and excess of Iraq, which in some ways also discredited the idea of democracy promotion in the world because the war itself became associated with that agenda. But you also saw, and you still see today, you know, the war on terror frame being used by autocratic leaders to justify their own policies around the world. And importantly, as Anne said, the American creations of social media platforms and development of artificial intelligence that seemed like these tools of incredible empowerment of individuals. And yes, they did empower individuals. I don't want to suggest these things don't have positive benefits, but disinformation, you know, social media becomes the perfect tool of the disinformation for someone like a Vladimir Putin, or the perfect tool of surveillance and control. And if you look at China and their use of technology, the blending together of data dominance by a government and the kind of dystopia of how they're able to use technology to kind of control what citizens can read and ultimately think, right? If you have such total control over the information flow in a society, these are things that, again, are not all totally American creations, but I thought the excesses of our brand of capitalism, our brand of kind of post 9/11 militarism.
Are you going to turn your back on America's fighting men when he come knock knock knocking at your front door?
No.
Attaboy, can't you see it now? As if it were almost tomorrow. Thousands of them.
Shoulder to shoulder.
That's right.
Heart to heart.
You said it, kid.
Satchel to page.
You got it.
You get it.
Oh, greetings from the President of the United States. Feet get moving.
Yes, sir.
What's that, boy?
Yeah, sir.
What do you say?
Yeah, sir.
Speak English, troop.
Yes, sir.
You ain't got no friends on the left.
You're right.
You ain't got no friends on the right.
You're left.
Hound dog.
One, two.
Boon tang.
Tree frog.
Hound dog. Boon tang. Coontown.
That's right.
Hound dog. Boon tang.
I'd rather be wild and ranch away from you. Hound dog. Boon tang.
And our technological innovation has contributed to the different flavors of nationalism and authoritarianism we see. Now, these are all areas where in the Obama years, you know, I feel like we were trying to address, you know, we were trying to promote a greater equality in terms of the American economy. We were trying to wind down wars and reshape America's role in the world. But the reality is America itself is an ocean liner, as President Obama used to always tell me. We could have done a lot of things better, I'm sure. But it's also the case that we have to get out of the habit of thinking that one president can come along and fix all these things. The question ultimately, this is my subtitle, is we have to decide, you know, what does it mean to be American? Does it mean doing the work of promoting and advancing a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy? Or does it mean, I think, what it means to Trump, which is this is a country that is supposed to belong to some people only and not others. And that ultimately, I think, is the contest that is playing out, which is why things are so intense in American politics right now.
Just in the last few minutes that we have, and I'll ask you first, Ben, what are you most worried about?
I'm most worried about, within the United States itself, what I'm most worried about is the extent to which some people are they're not living in reality.
Knowledge for the people, he said. Give them a light, and they'll follow it anywhere. We think that is a fair and a wise guy for rule to be guided by.
What is reality?
And we're not afraid of it, are we?
And so, you know, it's one thing you know, there can be people who have intense disagreements with me, and I'm sure I'm wrong about some things about the role of government or American foreign policy, but the sky is blue.
Because the sky is blue, it makes me cry. Because the sky.
But then, as you know, chinchillas, or mutated chinchillas like these, blue mutants we call them.
Is that because of their peculiar coloration, Brad, that makes them so rare?
No. They were first crossbred or introduced, as we say, by Alistair Blue, a mutations expert who's been into the raising of these little sweethearts. Oh, careful there.
Is he getting away?
That's all right. We get a lot more of them.
And climate change is real. And Joe Biden won the election. And when you look, you cannot ignore the fact that because of the collapse of the media ecosystem in this country and the development of a very powerful media ecosystem that combines social media, talk radio, television news, there's a bunch of my fellow Americans who are living in a different reality. And that, to me, is hugely corrosive to a democracy. I think globally, what worries me is how, if you look at Hong Kong, it's kind of in miniature where this blend of capitalism and technological innovation and totalitarianism can lead, where you have the appearance of a society that is working in some ways, it's generating a degree of wealth, but you are losing all forms of individual liberty and agency. And that, to me, is why the Hong Kong protest movement should be such a warning. These people did not want to opt into that model, even though it could deliver prosperity. And we need to listen to those types of voices before it's too late in our own societies.
And what are you most concerned about?
I'm most concerned about a stolen election, a failed election, perhaps one in which the Republican Party has managed to alter votes or there's a possibility they could use state legislatures to overthrow or throw out votes in states that go to a Democrat.
Which they tried to do
in 2020. I'm worried they'll try it again in 2024, and I'm worried they'll succeed. And that could lead to an extended period of unrest. And I think anything that can be done, either by Republicans or Democrats, to prevent that from happening is extremely important.
These are two bracing books, and it's great to speak with you both about this and where we may go from here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Anne Applebaum's book, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, is out in paperback this week. Ben Rhodes' new book is After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. And that's it for The Current.
Here they come, international loan sharks, backed by the guns of market hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity by turning countries into labor camps. Modern slavers and draggers, champions of freedom. Sinister, cynical instrument who makes the gun to the sacrament. The only response to the deification of tyranny by so-called developed nations, idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a flying fuck about the people in misery. IMF, dirty IMF, takes away everything it can get. Always making certain that there's one thing left. Keep them up. Feeders passing themselves off as leaders. Kiss the ladies, shake hands with the fellows, and it's open for business like a cheap bordello. And they call it democracy. 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 See the loaded eyes of the children too, trying to make the best of it the way kids do. One day you're gonna rise from your habitual feast to find yourself staring down the throat of the beast they call a revolution.